Hello and welcome to the Fitness Mindset Podcast with Kate Newdecker. So on this episode, I'm joined by clinical psychologist Joe O'Brien. He runs the Instagram page Head First and he continually puts out really helpful content surrounding mental health. I decided to invite him onto the podcast to chat about binge eating disorder, emotional eating and the effect that exercise has on anxiety. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. Okay, so Joe, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast today. So I think for the listeners, it'd be great if you could give them a little bit of your background and a little introduction to yourself, because I think you do it better than I do it.
Let's hope so. My name's Joe O'Brien. I run the Instagram page Head First with a zero at the end, because Head First was not available. That's the story behind that one that everyone always asked me. So I have a BSc and an MSc in psychology and health psychology, and basically I've worked in both clinical and subclinical inpatient and outpatient settings in both Ireland and in the UK, and my Instagram was kind of set up just to spread the word about mental health, spread the word about psychology. And I think an awful lot of the time when people hear, oh, it's a mental health page, they think, oh, depression and anxiety. But I cover a lot more than that. I feel like psychology is such a huge part of everyday society, from like what we're going to talk about in terms of eating to mental health issues to motivation to decision making. You know, there's so much more to psychology than just mental health issues per se. So what I would love people to kind of maybe get their head around or understand more of is the basics of psychology. And that's what I want to do with my page. So that's a little bit about me.
Perfect. Yeah, that was going to go on to my next question of like, why did you start the page and why do you do what you do? And is it sort of as well, because there's a lot about reducing stigma as well. Would you say it's about reducing stigma about mental health as well?
Yeah, well, the reason I actually set it up in the first place was quite sporadic. A friend of mine was raising money for men's mental health, and he has no background in mental health. He has no, you know, he has no significant reason to be raising money other than he cares. And I kept thinking to myself, I'm actually doing nothing, even though I'm in this industry. I have this education. I work in the field. And between that and speaking with my manager that day about how toxic some of the social media content is around mental health, I decided that night to just set up this page, and it kind of exploded. So, you know, I've only been active on it for 3 or 4 months, and it's gained quite a lot of traction. So that was kind of the motivation behind it. In terms of stigma, one of the big things I find with stigma is miseducation. So people just not understanding correctly what mental health issues are. I know within my friend group and talking to people that people often make these general misconceptions like, oh, you're depressed because you do this, or, you know, you must be on the spectrum, which really irritates me, because people don't understand what that means, you know, and it shows the level of misinformation that's out there and misunderstanding around mental health. And I think through education that will hopefully reduce the stigma on some level, even if it's only on a tiny scale.
Absolutely. I really hope so. And I think pages like your page are really helping to do so, especially on social media, because with the influx of reducing stigma, and I'm doing that with inverted commas, because there's people saying things like on a spectrum, they're terms that not many people actually know the meaning of. However, if there's more accounts like yours that are actually educating people and empowering people with knowledge, hopefully that's going to reduce that even more. So I think I personally think it's fantastic.
No, thank you. The response has actually been fantastic, something that I definitely couldn't have expected, and something that's kind of motivated me to keep it going. You know, would I have still kept it up if nobody was engaging with it? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But the response has been fantastic, and it's absolutely motivated me to keep going.
Fabulous. Cool. Awesome. So, I mean, you recently had quite a few questions come in about, particularly about binge eating, and it's something that I get quite a few questions about, and it's not necessarily something that is completely my scope of practice as a fitness and nutrition coach. However, it's definitely in your scope of practice. So it's fantastic that you've come on the podcast today to talk a little bit about binge eating and answer some of the questions that you've been receiving as well. So one of the questions is, and this is quite an important one, and I think it's something that's good to address initially, is someone's asked the best way to lose weight while struggling with binges. I'm going to literally just initially put it straight to you to answer this question, even though I want to jump in, but you go.
honestly, from my perspective, first of all, I think it's important to realize that I'm not a specialist in eating behaviors or eating disorders specifically. Mm-hmm. My knowledge comes from some of my experience and my educational background. Mm-hmm. So I don't treat these disorders, but what I have is an understanding in terms of what they look like and from experiences that I've seen. And from my perspective, it's especially in relation to this question, it's so important to go to a mental health professional if you feel like you're struggling with any aspect of mental health, because it's especially with eating disorders. Disordered eating is one of two mental health disorders that can actually result in mortality. The side effects of you know, malnutrition can get to the point where somebody can actually die. Similar, the other one is actually addiction. So obviously overdosing can cause death as well. But that is the kind of seriousness of disordered eating. And I think that's super important to just set out from the outset that mm-hmm. if you identify with any of the struggles that we talk about, absolutely go and see a mental health professional. Worst case scenario is that they say, you know, maybe you do have an eating disorder, but at least you're in the best place to kind of go and fix that then afterwards. And the best case scenario is they say, actually, you're kind of worried about nothing and, you know, maybe some stress management techniques or whatever it is, and then send you on your way. But from the off, I just want to say that if anyone is struggling with these issues, even just asking for a professional's opinion is going to be a massive relief rather than just diving straight into self-management. But to get back to the question, sorry, I just went on a big rant there at the start. But in terms of losing weight while struggling with binges, I think the first thing that anyone should do is fix your relationship with food first. Because no matter what the diet is, or no matter what, you know, there's so many different diets, no matter where or what aspect or what avenue you want to go down, if you have a poor relationship with food in the first place, no diet or no kind of weight loss technique is going to stick for you. If you follow a food plan, you know, it's only useful if you can stick to it. And if it's restriction that's causing you to binge, or that's, you know, creating an environment where you feel like you need to binge, then you're not going to make any progress. So like it is for loads of people that they see restriction or tracking calories or whatever their behavior looks like, and they see that as like a positive, oh, this is preventing me from binging. But in reality, it's kind of teeing you up to binge. So I would say first things first in terms of losing weight while struggling with binges is fix your relationship with food before anything else.
Absolutely, because it can be a cycle that is never ending, and you don't realise that actually the restricting phase is actually what contributes to it, like you say. And people seem to think, from experience, they seem to think that the binging is the problem, but a lot of the time it's actually the phase running up to that, the reasoning for it. We've got another question here, and it says, why does binge eating happen at night?
This is a really interesting one, because it's one that people kind of don't realise the science behind it. In terms of why it happens at night, right, there's a couple of things that make us more susceptible to impulsive eating or lose our self-control. Now we're more at risk of binging at night, because if you're tired, first of all, you're going to show visible cognitive deficits. And what that means is that you're less likely to control your impulses. You will be less likely to resist, you know, that thing that you're craving right now. Similarly, it's at the end of the day, you could be stressed. And we know that emotion and stress has a huge part to play in terms of being able to control your cravings and being able to control your relationship with food. And another, I wouldn't say risk factor, but another kind of trigger that can manifest in somebody binging is being alone. And for some people, obviously not everybody, but for some people, when they're at nighttime, they would be alone. And between those things and things like alcohol and also obviously being hungry, those things they leave you more likely or more susceptible to binging. So when people ask, why does it happen at night? More than likely, it's because one of those things is happening to you. So it makes it, basically, your brain is in a position where it's less likely to kind of be able to facilitate a healthy relationship with food. You're more likely to give in to your cravings and yeah, you're basically more likely to give in to those temptations or have less self-control than you had before.
Absolutely. And would you say that that's, you talked about loneliness there, and that's and loneliness can sometimes, I suppose you class it as an emotion. Would you class that as maybe emotional eating instead of binge eating, or can you differentiate the two?
Yeah, this is a really, really common question. And the thing is that it's quite difficult, right? Because binge eating itself, so binge eating disorder is a mental health disorder. Some of the kind of characteristics of that would be, first of all, it's always recurring. So it's something that happens regularly. You eat faster than normal, you eat more than normal. You have this kind of feeling that you're absolutely never full, but it also has associated psychological symptoms. So along with binge eating disorder, you'll have things like guilt and shame. You might feel really depressed, or you might feel really down after a binge session. It also is not accompanied by any compensatory behaviour, so things like purging, there's none of that involved in binge eating disorder. But the differences between that and emotional eating, they run quite close together, because if you don't qualify for binge eating disorder and you're kind of subclinical, you're not enough to kind of get diagnosed with a mental health disorder, a lot of that can kind of be caught up with emotional eating. But the triggers for binge eating can range from anything. You know, they can be from self-esteem to body image issues or emotion, of course, environment. It might be kind of a habit or a bad behavior or a kind of a coping strategy that you've got into. Whereas emotional eating, the triggers are generally emotion or stress. It's generally not the internal turmoil or things like previous emotional trauma. So I guess the triggers are different, first of all. You can be an emotional eater without binging. So if you turn to a specific food or you eat highly palatable foods, but you might not, you know, keep eating until you're way past full. These kind of things, you know, there's aspects of emotional eating that tie into binge eating, but, you know, you can be an emotional eater without binging. And similarly, you can be a binge eater without it relating to emotion at all. Although they do kind of cross over, and that's what makes it so difficult to differentiate between the two.
Absolutely, but I think you did a good job of differentiating the two, definitely. But if, for example, there is obviously a lot more, there's a lot more on social media about binge eating disorder, and also there's quite a few life coaches on social media that seem to dish out advice on binge eating disorder. Now, right. That can, in my opinion, that can be slightly more, I've seen more people become aware of it, but then also become a bit more hyper aware of this. Now, would you say that there's some instances that people would class something as a binge, where it might not be a binge, it might just be overeating to a certain extent, maybe at a social occasion or something like that? And where do you think it's important to draw the line, or is there even a line?
So the thing is with binge eating disorder, you can binge eat without qualifying or without meeting the criteria for binge eating disorder. So although you might have a mental health disorder that is binge eating disorder, you still might identify with some of the symptoms. And the problem is that there's kind of subclinical, where you're at the stage where you're not quite enough to be diagnosed with a disorder, is not clear. Because in psychology, we have pretty, you know, stringent criteria. It's very straightforward and makes sense. You know, you tick these boxes and you have this disorder or whatever it is, and it's up to a clinician to then define if you have a disorder. But the subclinical, when you don't meet that criteria, you know, it's up to interpretation. So I guess it depends. I wouldn't be able to know unless I saw a specific case, but yeah. I think there definitely is a massive, massive confusion between the two, because they are so tightly linked, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's very individual and very case by case, I suppose, like you say.
100%, yeah, 100%.
So just going back to sort of the stress eating and the emotional eating, and deciding what is actually emotional eating. Now, say if someone has comfort ate, for example, it's also comfort eating. And then they get really angry at themselves, and a lot of the time people do. What are some of the things or tips that someone could do, someone could do to just try and dissipate some of that anxiety around overeating, for example?
Yeah, look, it's a massively common one. After people emotionally eat, or after people binge, like I said earlier, there's that kind of associated emotional turmoil, that kind of, you know, a lot of feelings can come up for people, especially around sometimes feeling like a failure if they're, you know, on a specific diet, or they might feel ashamed of themselves or guilty or whatever it is. But I think one key area of this, and something that many people can change almost at the flick of a switch, is, you know, it's kind of where black and white thinking and inflexible thinking comes in. The idea that if you take one step outside of your food plan or your program or whatever calories you're on or whatever that is, that you're a failure. And this kind of black and white line that you either are 100% perfect or you're a complete failure. And that thought process, that line of thinking just isn't helpful. I saw your post recently where I think, did you say something along the lines of, you don't have to get your body bikini ready?
Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's the one.
Something along those lines, yeah. But it's those kind of have to sayings, mm-hmm. that create this black and white thinking.
Absolutely.
And it's the idea that, I have to stop eating at 6. I have to get a bikini body. I have to cut carbs. You know, I can't go out because mm-hmm. I'm on a diet. I have to go to the gym. Part of getting to a stage where you don't feel like, basically when you don't feel awful after a binge, is getting rid of the rules, getting rid of the black and white way of thinking, and developing compassion for yourself. Because if you're, you know, if you are 90% of the time fantastic with your food and 10% of the time you beat yourself up to the point where you ruin the rest of your, you know, you being really healthy, it's not of any worth for you. So developing that self-compassion and getting rid of those black and white rules is definitely something that anybody can do. If you're someone who struggles with binging, or actually if you struggle with any type of disordered eating where you have a poor relationship with food, it's very likely that being restrictive and being super, super strict on yourself is absolutely not for you, because it manifests in binging or disordered eating. So get rid of the rule book. I think it's the main tip. There is no perfect diet, you know. There's not one food group that should ever be out of bounds. Obviously, unless you have an allergy or something along those lines. But, you know, these rules create this black and white view of something that's not a black and white issue. So I think that'll be step one. Like, if there's guilt and shame associated with the way you eat, and you have thoughts like, oh, I shouldn't have eaten carbs, or shouldn't have got a takeaway, or whatever it is that looks like for you, just literally get rid of the rule book. Stop being so strict on yourself, and have some self-compassion. Because, you know, if you have a poor relationship with food, I'd address that obviously before trying to hit a weight goal or follow a new diet. But if you're struggling with that psychological side of food, then having the, you know, if you're not first, you're last attitude, or having that black and white line, is just not helpful. You know, it's one of the primary predictors of disordered eating, is people being overly focused or kind of preoccupied with food, with weight, with size, you know, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So they themselves are predictors or triggers for people to then develop disordered eating. So I think that's something that anybody can really do, and almost at the flick of a switch.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm so pleased I invited you onto the podcast to speak about it, because in the fitness industry there are so many people and coaches speaking in absolutes about things, and it's this or it's that, and you must follow this protocol very rigidly, and then it can be a breeding ground for eating disorders. And that might sound a little bit dramatic, but anecdotally, from my experience, I've seen it happen a lot, where very restrictive programs and very intense fitness programs can create a negative relationship with food and exercise in an industry that's actually supposed to make you feel good and make you healthier, which is completely counterproductive. So I'm really pleased you've popped on the podcast today to cover this huge topic.
Yeah, absolutely. Like in, I feel like in any walk of life, there is no black and white. Like, there are so many gray areas. There's no one diet that's the best. There's no one exercise that's the best. You know, people, I guess it sells, you know. If people can go out and say, never eat, one article that I saw on The Independent online, I think 2 or 3 years ago, was, you need to stop eating avocados immediately. This is why. And I was like, what is this nonsense, right? I was literally laughing to myself. I was going, this is absolute nonsense. So I clicked in and they were saying, oh, this recent study has found that avocados do X, Y, and Z. But in going on to the study, they found that avocados at a, you know, outrageous at an outrageous quantity are really dangerous for somebody that has a rare genetic mutation that affects 1 in 3,000 people.
Jesus.
And I honestly shook my head. I was like, this is absolute nonsense. And it was that day that I unfollowed the Independent UK. I was just like, or the Independent Online. And I was just like, it's just too much. You could, like, if you say, oh, balance is great and you should have a moderately balanced diet and do some exercise during the week, that's not going to sell anywhere and that's not going to get any traction. So I think that's part of the problem. But I think it's something that people need to realize is that there is no black and whites when it comes to psychology, when it comes to mental health, physical health, whatever it is, that there's always kind of another way around it.
Absolutely. And I think it's usually one of the common things that I speak to guests on the podcast, because I usually invite people onto the podcast who have the same kind of viewpoint, the same ethos with this thing. But it is very true that it's always the black and whites that sell, always polarization that's on social media is going to get the most traction, unfortunately. But eventually people will see the truth and they will come around to it. And there is a small circle on social media that you can get into and you can start following the right content. Like you said, you just unfollowed them, and I do the same with a lot of people, because you're in control of what you consume, so you know to take control of that and you know what to do. And I think that's what's important with education. You're always empowering people to question everything they read and make sure that it's going to be helpful for them.
100%.
So I mean, if someone has been struggling with binge eating disorder, for example, Is there a way, this is a question that's come in, can you ever fully recover from binge eating disorder?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Can you ever fully recover from binge eating disorder?
Well, the short answer is yes. I did a post on this actually, or I did a podcast on this myself, my very first podcast, and it was titled What Can I Do About My Mental Health Issue, or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And basically, the long story short is that mental health is on a continuum, right? Again, not black and white.
Yeah.
It's not, if you have binge eating disorder, it's not like having a flu virus inside your body, in that it's either present or it's not present. It's on a continuum. So if you are at the very bottom end of binge eating disorder and you're really, really struggling, it's likely that, you know, you'll get better to an extent, and then you'll still binge a little bit, and then a little bit less, and a little bit less, and you'll get to the point where you've really positive mental health. So there's also nothing kind of stopping you really struggling and not looking after yourself and then slipping back down that continuum. So, like, I don't know if I'm describing this well enough, but basically you can recover in that you can show none of the symptoms, you can not think about in your day-to-day life, you can get to a point where you've fantastic mental health, and you know, you don't have a second thought about food. However, if you don't look after your mental health and do things, you know, if you stop doing the things that got you to where you are, then there's nothing stopping you going kind of back down that continuum. It's not like a physical illness where, you know, you take the medicine and it's gone, and then something has to infiltrate your body to get that disease back or whatever it is. It's literally on a continuum. So at any point, you're at risk if you don't look after your mental health, essentially.
Absolutely. I think that's really important, that I think when people have any issues with their mental health or their relationship with their food, they sometimes seem to think if they fix it, that's going to be it. They're not going to have to work at all the rest of their life or that kind of thing. It's not like it's an arduous task that it's, oh, I'm going to be stuck with this forever. It's not like that. It's just everyone's going to be working on their relationship with food. Everyone's going to be working on their relationship with themselves if they're of that mindset to do so. So, like you said, continuum is a perfect way to put it, I think.
Oh, yeah. I compared it in my podcast to physical fitness. So if you are, like, let's say you're banging average, medium, middle of the road guy, and you really work on your physical fitness, and you get to a point where you can run a marathon, you know, in, I don't know, European record, let's say, there's nothing stopping you from not looking after your physical health to the point where, you know, you put on a lot of weight, you're overweight, you can't run anymore, you're getting physical health problems, and you're back down that continuum to the bottom. Mm-hmm. So if that person gets to that stage, you know, they weren't looking after themselves or their physical fitness, so they've gone down the continuum. And much similar in that, if they're at a point where they're really struggling with their weight or they're massively overweight and have significant health problems outside of that, there's nothing stopping them getting healthier. You know, they're still on that continuum. And if someone who is really overweight gets to a normal weight and is a healthy, you know, of healthy mind and healthy body at that stage, you're not going to say, oh, that person's cured of obesity, mm-hmm. because it could come back given, you know, certain lifestyle factors. Similar to the way that you can't say you're cured from a mental health issue because, again, certain lifestyle factors or significant stressors might put you back in that zone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's anecdotally as well. Obviously, I've suffered from anxiety in the past, and I found a massive helping with my anxiety was to exercise. So obviously I can vouch for the benefits of exercise helping with my anxiety. However, what is the evidence, like scientific evidence, of links between exercise and alleviation of mental disorders, for example?
It's actually fantastic. It's incredible. Obviously you can have positive and negative relationships with exercise, and specifically with eating disorders, it can be a compensatory behavior. So I would watch out for like your reasoning behind it, if it's compulsive and that kind of thing. But in terms of if you're struggling with your mental health, exercise is one of the, I would say, behind sleep. Now, don't quote me on that, but sleep is number one for mental health disorders. Fantastic predictor of mental health issues, and often, you know, it's present in so many psychiatric disorders. So getting your sleep right is a basic that anyone can do to promote their mental health. And don't underestimate how powerful that is, you know, getting the kind of lifestyle factors right. But exercise specifically, again, fantastic for mental health. I know that it's as good as antidepressants in tackling mental health with absolutely no side effects. So to the point where the NHS in the UK actually prescribe exercise as one of their treatments for mild to moderate depression. Mm-hmm. So if you're someone who's weighing up, you know, oh, should I go on medication or whatever, literally you should ask your GP or the mental health professional, would exercise be suitable for you? Because it's absolutely fantastic. Now, it's not a cure for everything, but it has been shown to be effective in alleviating symptoms such as, you know, depression, anxiety, like you said, and even just simple stress management and building resilience. And I did a post on this on my Instagram on exercise for mental health, and they, what one study showed, I think it was Cassandra Lowe was the name of the lady. Mm-hmm. That could be wrong, but what she showed is that physical exercise actually builds mental resilience.
Yeah.
So what they found was they initiated a stress response in the brain, and what they found was people who exercised, and even more intensely the better the benefit, but people who exercised, their brains returned back to normal far quicker than people who didn't exercise, or even people who exercised to a lesser extent. Mm-hmm. So you're actually building mental resilience to all these mental health disorders by exercising. So it's not only is it potentially part of a kind of a recovery program, it can be a fantastic part of a recovery program, but it's also a preventative.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's something that obviously you can experience when you're training, in that pushing past that those feelings of discomfort, knowing that it's going to be making you fitter, making you stronger. It can, for me, massively, it transfers to other parts of my life. But also for clients, I've also spoken of it as well, that it makes them feel a little bit stronger when they're dealing with situations in their personal life and also with their confidence as well. So it's really actually good to hear that there are actually research papers about these things as well. It's kind of reassuring in a way, which is great.
Oh, 100%. Like, the research is, like, there's absolutely no question about, in the research base, of the link between exercise and positive mental health. Absolutely none. Like, there's absolutely no debating it, especially for the common ones like depression, anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, we've spoken here about, obviously, the positive effects of exercise and your mental health. Now, sometimes there can be, like, you touched on any compensatory behaviours with exercise, like burning off food and kind of almost punishing yourself with exercise for eating food. What would you say leads to these behaviors and these compensatory habits, for example?
It's so varied depending on the individual, but it would likely be similar to the root causes of disordered eating, for example, mm-hmm. in that, you know, it could be related to self-esteem, it could be related to internal issues, it could be it literally could be anything. It could be social media triggered, it could be miseducation. You know, there's so many different potentials for why compensatory behaviors occur, but if it's occurring in tandem with an eating disorder, I would imagine that they're probably closely linked.
Absolutely. And I usually bang on about this, and I get absolutely irate when I see a commercial gym using a slogan like 1,000 calorie burn workout, or burn off your pizza, or after Christmas it was like burn off your turkey. And would you say that these can affect people's relationship with exercise, for example?
I'd imagine so. First of all, like it's marketing, right? Again, the whole clickbait thing. It's basic psychology marketing, because mm-hmm. people need to realize there is no 1,000 calorie workout. You know, no matter what you Google to say, you know, what does 50 squats burn off? It's entirely subjective and person dependent on, you know, how much effort you put in or how deep you go in your squat or how long it takes you or whatever it is. But mm-hmm. what these ads do and these marketers do is, you know, it gives you the impression that you should be burning off your pizza. Mm-hmm. It creates that kind of that seed of guilt, mm-hmm. Or that you should be exercising exactly what you eat. But again, like that's completely unhealthy. Mm-hmm. It basically is, like you said, a compensatory behavior. You're saying, oh, it's okay to eat pizza, but only if you work it off. But like that, mm-hmm. it's just such a poor mentality to have. Mm-hmm. When in reality, you know, you should give yourself permission to eat what you like. And again, it kind of ties back into that black and white rule about dieting and about exercise. There is no, you have to do this, you have to do that. It's okay to eat a pizza. Like, it's okay to not work off everything you eat. In fact, it's incredibly unhealthy to try and do that, because you're going to end up overly focused. You're going to end up with your preoccupation around your weight. You know, oh, I ate 440 calories. That means I have to stay on this bike for 1 hour and 12 minutes. Do you know what I mean? This kind of preoccupation with weight, with size, with diet, calories, macros, is one of the primary predictors, like I mentioned earlier, of disordered eating.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure you see it yourself, but disordered eating obviously has massive ties with exercise.
Massively, yeah.
Of course, it doesn't create those issues for everybody, but for someone who does struggle with relationship with body or relationship with weight, it can absolutely be problematic for those individuals to suggest that you have to burn off your pizza or you should feel guilty for not matching your exercise with your food intake.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I think it is the preoccupation, like you say, with the way your body looks and aesthetics training, essentially, in the gym that can lead to that poor relationship with exercise and obviously food as well. And it's something that I try to promote to get away from with the way I train people and what I try to promote with my page. And obviously, just because as well, if you are looking to get leaner, the main part of that isn't necessarily going to be how much you exercise. The main bulk of it is going to be actually what you do with your nutrition. So it's not only about the relationship you have with food and exercise and how you feel about it. It's more about actually what is scientifically going to work. And
100%.
Yeah. But unfortunately, like you say, marketing, people want to make money. Gyms want to make what they do a lot bigger than what it is. So obviously they're gonna do that.
But just one more thing on that is I think people, like, okay, my nutrition knowledge wouldn't be amazing by any means, but I think people get the impression that mm-hmm. when people say, oh, burn off all the calories that you eat or whatever, that they forget that outside of exercise, we still burn calories.
Yeah.
So when you're trying to burn off more than you eat, you're forgetting that you might burn another 800, 1,000, 1,500 calories just by living, just by breathing, just by sitting at home.
Absolutely.
And that they're creating this massive, massive thing of, like you said, burn off your pizza or burn off your Christmas mm-hmm. or whatever the marketing slogan is, that
yeah.
it can actually be unhealthy to try and do that, because you're probably massively under eating as well as over exercising if you're trying to hit exactly what you're eating.
Absolutely fabulous point, Joe. Definitely, because I think people don't have quite the understanding of what their energy expenditure is. And like you say, there's obviously the energy expenditure just to live, and for most, even like a small human being, it would probably be at minimum, bare minimum, 1,300, 1,500 calories. So if you think about that in the grand scheme of things, that could be what you think in your head is actually you overeating. That could be a meal,
absolutely.
What you think is really blowing it. That could, you already burned that in the day, so it's really not anything in the grand scheme of things you should be worried about. And I think it comes from this huge preoccupation about the way you look and this pressure that people put on themselves. And this is going slightly off piece. Would you say that you started the page that you started because there is that kind of like growing tendency that social media is bad for people's mental health? Would you say that social media is in some ways negative for the preoccupation with people's bodies and fitness, maybe?
Again, person dependent, because we see an awful lot of we see an awful lot in the media that social media is causing depression, it's causing anxiety, it's causing eating disorders, it's causing X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Again, I wouldn't say it's a cause, because if it was a cause, then there'd be far, everybody who's on social media, there'd be a huge proportion of them with all those issues.
Yeah.
However, I would definitely say that it's a risk factor for some people. So if you're somebody, for example, who struggles already with their self-esteem, that could be exacerbated, or it could be triggered by something that you come across on social media. Not specifically because you're on social media, but you've had those issues already, and that might be a trigger or a risk factor or something that contributes towards you developing something.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's not a sole cause. There is no single cause of a mental health issue. You often hear, genetics is the reason that, depression is in my family, or, I have anxiety because of X, Y, and Z, or I have PTSD because of X, Y, and Z. The likelihood is that there's more than one contributing factor. The likelihood is that it's probably an umbrella kind of that covers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not explaining this very well. That there's plenty of roots to the tree, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There's more than one thing that contributes to mental health issues, and somebody solely blaming social media, probably not the answer. But again, I can see why it contributes to anxiety and contributes to depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I think as well that there's so much clickbait about social media being so terrible and about it affecting mental health negatively. And it's just another marketing tool. It's like, I mean, to be honest, there's so many people that use social media and they don't see negative effects on their mental health from it.
The reality is that the data isn't there, because social media kind of exploded in, 2008, maybe when Facebook started, or 2009. The data of kind of longitudinal data that is of high quality in psychology just isn't available there in terms of the long-term impact of social media.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know is that, there are plenty. I actually did a post on this 2 days ago, I think, maybe 3 days ago, about a social media detox. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that people people who are engaged more in social media, so people who log on more, basically who spend more time on it, had more of a benefit when they came off it. So if they gave up social media, but they were someone who used it really, really seriously before, they saw quite a big improvement in their well-being, whereas people who didn't use it that much didn't really see that much of a difference. As well as that, people who are passive users versus active users, so people who scroll through but don't like anything, don't message people, don't engage, those people also saw a significant improvement in their well-being compared to people who were very active with others on it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we know in psychology and in all types of science, I guess, that these studies are only one piece of the puzzle. It doesn't mean that, mental health is deteriorating because of social media. It just means that in this particular study, that these type of people were, they improved when they took a break from social media. But we can't make a blanket statement at the moment about how social media impacts mental health, because you know, it's the data just isn't comprehensive enough, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And people, when they read these things, they love a villain. They love to, like, point on something, one particular thing for their problems. Like, oh, it must be social media. But they completely forget about how it's put them in contact with certain people. Like, we wouldn't be having this, making this podcast right now if it wasn't for social media. And people might listen to this podcast and actually it might help people. So, to be honest, for me, the positives outweigh the negative. But I understand people do find it negative in some ways.
Sorry, just lastly on that, it can tie back to black and white thinking that people are saying, oh, look at it, it has to be social media, but it's actually a number of things, you know, there's not just one cause of everything.
It's literally everywhere. This black and white thinking is literally everywhere. Every podcast that we do, we get to the end of it, we're like, yep, it's black and white thinking, it's polarization, and it's speaking in absolutes, and it has to go. And then you're like, oh, well, I'm speaking in absolutes about that, and you're just like, oh, do you know what, you just get in this, like this whole really deep philosophical conversation in a fitness nutrition podcast. So yeah, gets a little bit too deep. cool. So I'm just going to go back to some more of the questions because I know that some people sent these in to you and you want, it'd be great if we could cover as many of them as possible really in regards to them as well in terms of like binge eating. So I'm completely skipping back and going on to back onto that topic again. So someone sent a message and they said, does tracking food for a long time have an impact on binging?
Okay, so like I mentioned earlier, with food and calories and weight, if you have a preoccupation, it can promote that disordered eating. So look, some people track with absolutely no adverse effects. I would be one of them. I track my macros. Well, not anymore. I used to track my macros, but had no adverse effects from it. It was useful for me. But again, that's, you know, you hear people saying, oh, you have to track your macros. It's the most accurate way. You have to do this, you have to do that. Black and white thinking, it doesn't work like that. The whole N equals one thing I find fantastic. And I only came across the N equals one phrase when I came onto social media. But N is the symbol that's used in data collection or in scientific studies that represents the amount of people in that study. And what we're saying when we say N equals one is that that's one person's opinion.
Yeah.
So it's not applicable to the general public. So if somebody says to you, you know, oh, I tracked my macros and I did this and I did that, that it's so irrelevant that person did that because it's not applicable. You're a different person to them. You'll react differently than them. And again, tracking is person dependent, but we know that the preoccupation can have adverse effects. So if you find yourself being really overly strict towards binging, do try and remove it and try and focus on developing a better relationship with food and see if tracking your macros or tracking your calories is something that has a negative impact on you. You might find that coming off that might actually improve your binge-related behaviours or your food-related behaviours. So it's kind of like a personal trial, what works for you. But we do know that it can have adverse effects.
Yeah, I think that's true as well. And I think it's something, like you said, the N equals one thing is actually really, really interesting because with the rise of evidence-based coaching, everything is evidence-based, it can become very, very reliant on certain studies and this one source of research, this one paper. And the thing is that you don't know if that paper is going to be relevant, you don't know the context, you don't know how to interpret that information as well. So while evidence-based practice is fantastic, it can get a lot of the questions that come in can be like, does tracking food, for example, for a long time have an impact on binging? It's like in relation to what? And that's why you answer questions so well and saying, well, it depends on the individual. It always depends. Yeah. It just always depends on you at the end of the day.
And my manager in my job always talks about, as well as evidence-based practice, obviously, practice-based evidence. And that's things you know from the field.
Yeah.
So things you know from working in the industry. And from working in the industry, we know that, you know, this can work for some people. And when we talk about research papers and stuff, like even if I give you an example of a psychology paper, and the psychology paper shows that exercise reduces symptoms of depression, you know, that in the media is going to be exercise cures depression.
Yeah.
But if you read that study, what it shows is that it reduces symptoms at the same rate as antidepressants, which is only about 50%. So it's important to realize that, again, there is no one cure, there is no X, Y, and Z. It depends on that individual. And if it works for you, then use it. But if it doesn't, then don't use it. Don't rely on somebody, it working for somebody else, to automatically assume that that works for you.
Absolutely. And that's why there can be a little bit of danger. I've heard some people on social media say there's danger with saying things like exercise is medicine, food is medicine. And it's actually speaking in that broad blank statement that is can actually, it's not medicine. You know, it's like you said, it's 50%, and that's the same as medicine, but it's not medicine.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's important to bear that in mind as well. Another question that we have, this is an interesting one. Is it normal to binge only after drinking, I'm assuming alcohol? I never feel full after drinking or even when I'm hungover.
I actually did my my thesis in my master's on alcohol and hangover, and it was quite interesting. But what drinking does is it changes the area of the brain called basically the prefrontal lobes, which are the area of the brain that will help control your self-control. So everybody knows that when someone's drinking or drunk or even in a hungover state, that they're more impulsive. So when you say, is it normal to binge after drinking? I wouldn't say binging is ever normal, but it's certainly explainable, let's say. Yeah. So your binges are explainable through being drunk or being hungover because it makes it difficult. So you're more impulsive, you're less likely to resist temptation, you've less self-control, you've significant cognitive deficits that come with being drunk or being hungover. As well as that, if you're hungover, alcohol also impacts sleep. And we already spoke earlier about sleep and how important it is, but it creates similar cognitive deficits in that, you know, if you have a lack of sleep, actually, I think one study that I read recently shows an increase in hunger hormones, a decrease in the hormones that make you feel full. So leptin and ghrelin were both impacted by lack of sleep. And they showed that you're more likely to crave highly palatable foods. So the sleep issue after drinking is certainly an issue. Alcohol itself, obviously, is certainly an issue. So binge eating can be explained. If you're only binging after alcohol, then maybe look at your relationship with alcohol. But if that's what is the reasoning behind it, then it's certainly explainable that you're more likely to binge after you've drank.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that explains it pretty well. And I've got a personal question to ask you about. Since you have done your thesis on hangovers and I've been quite open on like social media and said, oh, when I'm hungover, I get really anxious. Like it affects my anxiety and to quite a high level. Now, what is the relationship between drinking and anxiety?
So alcohol impacts the areas of the brain alcohol affects all areas of the brain. Almost every aspect of your brain is impacted when you drink. But it impacts an area called the hippocampus, which is in charge of emotional regulation. And basically what alcohol does is that in the withdrawal from alcohol, I'm explaining this again really badly.
When you
drink, it increases serotonin, increases dopamine. Just for anyone who doesn't realize what those are, they are like happiness hormones, reward hormones. Serotonin is known as the happiness neurotransmitter. And low serotonin is associated with depression and can be associated with anxiety because the two overlap. And it increases dopamine as well. Dopamine is the reward chemical. So in drugs, you'll get a dopamine release and that will make you go back to that drug. So alcohol is a drug. It increases dopamine, increases serotonin. What happens in the withdrawal of alcohol, and not just in the hangover stage, but also potentially days, if not weeks afterwards, is that without that surge of serotonin and dopamine, it actually drops. So it's kind of like withdrawal in that you're not producing enough of the normal neurotransmitters and it exacerbates the symptoms of depression and anxiety. So it's literally a physiological change in your brain that's created by the withdrawal from alcohol.
Really interesting. I find it so, so interesting because it makes sense. And also for me, this is completely, obviously, my experience. Just hearing you talk about it in that sense, it kind of deflates the issue of it, because otherwise you're kind of left thinking when you're hungover, like, everyone else is fine when they're hungover, but I'm really anxious about stuff. And it's like, well, it's actually kind of normal to feel like that, because that's a normal withdrawal symptom, like you say.
100%, yeah, yeah. What alcohol actually also does is it impacts neurogenesis. And what that is the making of new brain cells.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is it takes, well, basically neurogenesis takes 4 to 6 weeks for all your cells to basically go all over the brain and go where they're supposed to be. And if you're a heavy drinker or you drink regularly, it's impacting your neurogenesis, which is your ability to replenish your brain cells after they die.
Mm-hmm.
And that can also have an impact on your mood for longer than just that hangover period. So often you find when people give up drink for a significant amount of time who struggle with mental health issues, that can be one of the contributing factors for them feeling so poor.
Really interesting. Thank you so much for answering that.
Yeah, no worries, no worries. I actually did a post on that on my page as well, back when I first started, but it was one of my most popular posts because lots of people don't realise what alcohol can actually do in terms of mental health.
Absolutely. Everyone's very concerned with the physical aspects of things and how you look and how your body feels. But like you say, the mental aspects of things are going to be so much more, they should be more popular. It's not even about what's popular and what's not. It's just, it is what it is. And things like your page are really going to help with people being more educated, more empowered with knowledge, essentially. So
I hope so.
It's really, really fantastic what you're doing. So, I mean, with everything that we've chatted about, I often say to people at the end of a podcast, if people could have some general tips dealing with a certain aspect of what they're struggling with. So I think a lot of the time when people go to the gym, if they're new to fitness and they're new to the gym, they can feel a little bit anxious about stepping foot in the gym. What would be your top tips for someone to feel confident in the gym?
Feel confident in the gym. First of all, you don't have to use the gym. Mm-hmm. There's other options for exercise, other ways mm-hmm. to achieve your goals.
Good point.
What would I recommend? I'd recommend maybe, I love, especially for anxieties and fears, I love the fear ladder approach. Mm-hmm. So what that is, you can also call it fear setting. They kind of overlap. But I think it's a really good self-help tool to get over fears or anxieties.
Mm-hmm.
So what it does is it helps you identify, first of all, steps towards achieving your end goal,
mm-hmm.
But also reflecting on your experiences through the process and seeing the kind of the thought processes or the kind of distortions that exist within your way of thinking. So one of the things that we know in anxiety is that people are generally anxious about something that is kind of irrational or it's disproportionate. It's a disproportionate feeling of worry. So that's what anxiety really is. It's disproportionate to the situation. So you might ask yourself about the gym, you know, why would anybody worry about the gym? And that's why it's kind of disproportionate. It's for somebody who's been to the gym for like 12 years, it doesn't make sense to me why someone would be worried about going. And we find that in anxiety, people have these thought processes that are, let's say, distorted. So one of the things we can do, like I said, is the fear ladder. And part of that is asking yourself why you're worried about it. What's the worst thing that could happen? What's the best thing that could happen? If the bad thing happens, what are you going to do? Is that, you know, can you get over that if it happens? Another thing to ask yourself is, are you acting on opinions or are you acting on facts? Because generally people's opinions who suffer with anxiety, they're generally a little bit warped. So, you know, they might think, oh, look, people are laughing at me when I'm in the gym. And like I said, I've been in the gym for 12 years and that's not generally something that happens from my experience. So measuring opinions versus facts and using fear setting. So fear setting, I think it's very difficult to explain without having kind of a visual look at what it looks like, but there is a fantastic YouTube video by Tim Ferriss. It's called Fear Setting. It might be called something like Setting Your Fears. But it works off similar principles in terms of the fear ladder. And the fear ladder is a technique that people use to tackle anxiety. So I'd highly suggest watching the fear setting video if anyone is worried about going to the gym or getting over any fear, really. But little things you can do in terms of, sorry, that was a really long-winded answer for something that had really simple steps. No, stepping from the gym for the first time, little things you can do is maybe go with a friend, go with a group, go when it's not that busy. So go outside those peak hours, go with a personal trainer until you're confident, or somebody who knows what they're doing, somebody who's been to the gym before, or maybe just go to a class or even get a tour around the gym just to get to know where everything is and kind of get your head around it. Because I know, right, even though I'd be confident enough in the gym, when you go into a new gym and you don't know where anything is, it can be kind of like you're tiptoeing around pretending like you know what you're doing, but in fact you're just looking around for the toilet or you're looking for a certain machine or whatever. So I think taking those little baby steps to get comfortable in the gym, or you know, just basically taking those small steps before you get to the big step, which is being able to go to the gym by yourself. I think those, taking the little steps, you know, walking before you can run, that kind of approach.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think with like all fears as well, like you say, those are some fantastic actions to take. So I think that will be very helpful for people. So thank you so much, Jo, for popping onto the podcast today. So I'd love for people to follow you on social media and find your content, because it is really helpful and really interesting at best anyway. So would you like to give your handles and how can people find you, for example, on social media and everywhere really?
So at the moment, just on my Instagram a couple of months ago, on Instagram you can find me at headfirst with a zero at the end. I have recently set up a Spotify for a podcast that I'm hoping to do a lot more content on. And that is called Head First Podcast, and it's by Joe O'Brien. So if you type both of those things in, you will find me. But at the moment, there's only one podcast on there. I'm hoping to fill it up pretty soon. And yeah, that's all the social media I have at the moment. But I generally answer my direct messages. So if you have any feedback for me or want to ask any questions or whatever, hit me up, shoot me a DM. I'll normally get back to as many of them as I can.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Joe, for having a little chat with me.
And thank you for having me on.